This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday pitch-in. The Indy 500 is this Sunday, and of course, it'll be run without fans. We're lucky to have the perspective of 2013 winner Tony Kanaan on the show later today. What's it like for the drivers to run a race with no fans? We'll also get an update from our business reporter, Samantha Horton, on the impact of this year's very different race on the track atmosphere in the town of Speedway. And finally, one Indiana school district that was hit hard by a spring coronavirus outbreak is reopening next week. We'll talk with education reporter Jeannie Lindsay about what it looks like and some of the concerns they have, including given their large population of English language learners. But first, we'll kick things off the way we always do with Indiana Public Broadcasting's digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not too bad. It was a big news week, but we'll start with the numbers on the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah. So as of noon, 2,992 people had died from COVID-19.
Just about to cross the 3,000 threshold in Indiana.
Yeah. For confirmed cases, for suspected or probable cases, we've been beyond 3,000 for a hot minute now. But there are more than 84,000 confirmed cases and more than 958,000 Hoosiers that have been tested. So comparing that to last week, we're up by, I have to do quick math, 6,000 confirmed cases and have tested a little. Nope, that math's not going to work. So comparatively, from last week, we had 886,000 Hoosiers. This week, 958. So new cases have continued to climb, but they have been doing so more slowly this week than the previous 2 weeks with the 1,000 case spikes. Today, the state reported 1,050 new cases, and yesterday, 955 new cases were reported. Again, these spikes are much higher than what we saw back in April. The state's rolling average also seems to be taking a little bit of a dip, which could be adherence to the governor's mask mandate from a couple of weeks ago. The thing to keep in mind is the data lag between from the state and Regenstrief, between the time being exposed to the virus and showing symptoms, and the intentional lag from the state, understandably, to parse out data from more than 92 different resources. The impact of school reopenings on our numbers is going to take some time to be reflected, as well as the greater impact of the governor's mask mandate, all of those things, the things that we've been doing to try and mitigate some of these spikes. That's going to take a little bit more time to be reflected in our numbers.
Indeed. It'll be interesting to see how things look 2-3 weeks from now and to see what school districts end up doing, if anything. So this week, we got a big statewide address from Governor Eric Holcomb. What was it about?
Yeah, it was about equality and equity in state government. So Governor Eric Holcomb says he wants to be a barrier buster to help reduce racial inequality in the Hoosier state. He laid out about half a dozen specific actions that he will take. The first is creating a new cabinet post, Chief Equity, Inclusion, and Opportunity Officer, to work across state government. The new hire would be the 19th member of Holcomb's cabinet. Three of the current group are people of color, and five are women. Holcomb will also mandate body cameras for every frontline state trooper by spring of next year, and he wants an outside group to review training at the Indiana Law Enforcement Academy, which instructs about two-thirds of police across the state. However, not included in Holcomb's announcement is a ban on chokeholds, which the Black Caucus, the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus, has called for. The administration says the issue is more complicated and is reviewing the use of force more broadly. But many of Holcomb's proposals involve data, including most notably the creation of a public disparity data portal, which is meant to reveal shortcomings across Indiana systems when it comes to equity and inclusion.
And we, of course, covered this on Tuesday when this address came down, and we took it live. And we also had some before and after discussion with Representative Earl Harris, who is vice chair of the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus. So what is their response to this, the creation of this new cabinet position?
Yeah. Basically, it's great, a great start, but it is still far from what's necessary to fix the state's pervasive problems. The Black Caucus Vice Chairman, Representative Earl Harris, who represents East Chicago, said much of the governor's plan lines up with the caucus's justice reform agenda, which they rolled out last week. But he said, but he added the new cabinet position exemplifies the need to wait on a verdict for Holcomb's plans. It only works, he said, if the right person is in the job and empowered to make changes. Harris said he's disappointed Holcomb hasn't responded to the Black Legislative Caucus's suggestions of banning chokeholds, no-knock warrants, and racial profiling. Administration officials say that they're seeking this outside review of law enforcement training and use of force broadly, but the review will come from a law enforcement group, and Harris said there should be civilian involvement as well. So there's a lot of there's some interesting nuance between these two plans.
We are recapping the state's news with our digital producer, Lauren Chapman, on our Friday pitch-in today. And what do we know about school funding on the fix that Governor Holcomb is trying out or at least suggesting?
Yeah, so last week, Governor Eric Holcomb basically made the suggestion that we would adjust when we were making student counts, which is a fairly substantial indicator of how much money schools are receiving. Mm-hmm. So something that he said would make funding stable through the fall, which that was in response to President Pro Tem Roderick Bray, who represents Martinsville. He wrote a letter warning schools of possible cuts if they offer online, if they only offer online instruction this fall. So that's the last 2 weeks of news. Following up, however, Martinsville schools, where Senator Bray represents, are starting online. But Superintendent Jay Arthur said student enrollment and the funding it determines also shapes other critical school decisions that rely on the budget, which means delaying the student count day could make things like negotiating teacher pay more complicated, because you can't negotiate on something that you don't have a final answer for what your budget is. State leaders assured schools in June that they would have full support for full funding of schools through the pandemic. And Arthur, as a superintendent, said warnings of possible cuts after schools have already started to reopen is, quote, frustrating and cast doubt on whether or not schools truly will receive 100% of the funding they estimated they would this year. He said instead of pushing back the student count date, the state should instead call a special legislative session to answer the funding questions raised by lawmakers and offer schools some very much needed clarity and stability during the pandemic.
Okay. All right. So we'll find out what happens there. And this week, the other big, really big news item was the fact that Planned Parenthood is dropping a lawsuit that it filed against Indiana. What was this about?
Yeah, so this is a 2016 law that requires women to get an ultrasound at least 18 hours before an abortion. Planned Parenthood of Indiana and Kentucky and the state agreed to end that lawsuit. Planned Parenthood had argued that that law meant women would have to make two separate trips of sometimes hundreds of miles for the procedure or pay for overnight lodging, which they said caused an undue burden on women's constitutional right to an abortion. Two different courts agreed, but earlier this year, the U.S. Supreme Court sent the case back to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals for rehearing, causing confusion among abortion rights advocates. So now Planned Parenthood has agreed to walk away from the lawsuit, provided that Indiana waits until January to enforce the law, mostly because Planned Parenthood, a Planned Parenthood clinic in Fort Wayne recently acquired an ultrasound machine, giving women more options to fulfill the requirement and making the legal argument a little less strong.
Okay, so it sounds like this law, then, if Planned Parenthood gets their way, will not take effect at least until early next year.
Yeah, that basically the negotiation that they've made with the state is if you don't enforce the law until January, we'll drop the lawsuit.
Okay, all right, and lawmakers are preparing for the session? Are we talking about next year's session, which is a big session? It's a budget session next year. How are they going to do it amid the pandemic?
Yeah, that's, you know, that's still an excellent question after their recommendations. So a panel of Indiana lawmakers is beginning to sort of kind of make recommendations or recommend changes to the 2021 session to adjust for the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. But some of the initial recommendations that they made on Monday are short on specifics. One of the committee's first priorities was how to adjust Organization Day, a technical meeting of the full legislature in mid-November. Typically, it's for swearing in lawmakers after the elections and making speeches about the upcoming session. But this year, it's likely the General Assembly will make major changes to state law and their rules on Org Day to, for example, allow legislators to vote remotely if necessary. But there's also the question of how to even conduct Organization Day. Staff estimates say the full Senate can be in its chamber and observe social distancing. But because of the size of the Indiana House, that might not be true for the other chamber. The committee did make a recommendation, however, that the Senate impose a 10-bill limit on how many pieces of legislation each lawmaker can file. The House already limits members to 10 bills during long budget writing sessions. So that's one tangible thing, but there's a lot of gray areas right now.
Indeed, indeed. And next year's session will be a big one to watch for. So thanks for that update. I've wondered how organization was going to go myself. So you and I have something going on Monday night.
We do, though I don't think it's statewide.
It's not statewide, but it is virtual. So anyone in Indiana could jump on if they want to. We're hosting News and Brews, current events. Well, usually it's pub trivia, but, we're not in a pub. You'll be in your home. You can sign up at our flagship station's website, WFYI.org. Mm-hmm. Go to the events page, and Lauren Chapman and I will be reading the questions on Monday night, and I'm looking forward to it.
It's not pub trivia. It's BYOB trivia.
Indeed. So you can, I'll leave it at that. I'll leave it at that. I don't want to talk about how much I imbibe over the weekend. Or Monday nights for that matter. But I will be, and I hope you will be too. And I'm looking forward to it, Lauren.
I can't wait.
All right. Lauren Chapman is our digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. We appreciate it. Up next, my interview with IndyCar driver and 2013 Indy 500 winner, Tony Kanaan. I'm Matt Pelzer. Back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Right now, we're going to talk about this year's very different Indy 500. Postponed to August, initially with the expectation of full attendance, then half, then 25%, and now we know the race will be run without fans in the seats this weekend. Here to talk with us now is 2013 Indy 500 winner Tony Kanaan. Tony, what an honor. It's great to have you.
Oh, thanks. Appreciate it to be here with you guys.
So a lot of this year's races have been run without fans already, and you're a fan favorite. People love to watch you. What's it been like racing without fans in the stands?
You know, it was extremely weird, but I should say that what's not weird around the world right now. So yeah. We're all having to adjust for so many things, the social distancing, the masks, and everything else. So I think it was always the right call. I mean, obviously, IndyCar, it's a sport that we're based on fans. We create our fan base. We became who we are because of, you know, the Indy 500 and having 400,000 people in the same place, the biggest single event in the world. So it was weird. I mean, for me, I mean, I've been in IndyCar for 23 years. I've never had done anything like that. I've never had a race without fans. Not even when I was go-karting, I was a little kid go-karting in the local go-kart track. You always had fans, even if it was just your mom and your dad, you know? So It's been different. I think, you know, we're all sad because we wanted to enjoy with the fans and have them around. But, you know, that is the right call. That's what we need to do for now. The good news is we're not going to ban fans from coming to the races in the future. Hopefully this will go away soon and eventually we'll have them back.
Well, what have those changes meant for the drivers and the teams, you know, the masks, the social distancing? I mean, you kind of got to get
in close quarters with some of these people. I mean, how's that changed the dynamic?
For us, it's just like for people that don't, it's like when you come to work, when you have a lot of people at your workspace and there is all of a sudden there is nobody there, you just show up and you do your work and you leave, you know. So for us, I mean, you know, IndyCar, we have autograph sessions during the weekend. We have fan interactions. Fans can actually buy a ticket to stay in the paddock around the trucks. So for me, it's been extremely weird. You just show up, you get in the car, you do the laps, and you leave, and there is no traffic driving in and out. That is really literally nothing around. So it's an adjustment. I think, like I said before, it's just the way the world is right now.
Does it change the feel for you considerably enough? I mean, have you felt yourself, feeling things that you haven't felt before, running a race or even practicing or things like that?
I mean, it is different, but I mean, it's just once you're in the race car, you don't think about it, to be honest. Once you put the helmet on, it's not that we actually, it's different than a basketball or a football game, right? That you can hear the crowd, that you can kind of interact with the crowd. We have the helmet and the engine that it's so loud that we go so fast that it's not that we're paying attention to what's going on in the stands. But, you know, it's definitely just a different feeling for sure.
Has it changed the feel for the races that you've run without fans? I mean, do you feel like there might have been different outcomes had there been the usual energy that you get from fans in the present?
Well, it's hard to say, but I mean, I definitely feel less energy, less, you know, like that's for sure. I mean, but the results, I mean, I doubt it. I mean, once, like I said, once you put the helmet down and you're racing. So you want to win regardless if that is one person or 10,000 people in the stands.
Here's a question. What'd you do on Memorial Day weekend this year?
I'm going to stay home. I mean, we stayed home. We obviously, I have four kids. We got to be careful. I was, you know, we knew we were going to be racing the following weekend, and 2 weekends later we raced in Texas, so we stayed. I mean, we cooked like normal. We watched an old Indy 500, actually, the 2013, which is the one that I won. I showed my kids. They're little kids, so they don't understand completely what's going on, but we watched that, and they saw mom and dad on TV. They saw dad winning the race, so that was quite cool.
Was there ever talk of, like, not doing the season? Was there ever talk? I mean, look at what so many other sports have done and so many other leagues have done and just completely canceling the season. Was that ever a worry of yours?
Nah, I'm pretty close to Roger and his team, Mark Myers and IndyCar. That was never an option. We always, unless somebody mandated that because of safety or, you know, whatever, you never know what's going to happen. Well, what could have happened, but no, it was never an option for us.
The time of year adds so many important variables. I mean, it can be a lot hotter and certainly a lot more humid this time of year in late August versus late May. How's that going to change things, you think?
It's going to change, you know, the behavior of the car for sure. The way we prepare for the race as far as hydration and everything else. So it's, although it's the same for everybody, but definitely different weather. The hot weather, affects our cars quite a bit. So we, you know, the hotter it is, the slippery it gets. So it's probably going to be a slippery one, but, it is the only thing we can't control. It's the weather. So that it's something that we can't worry about.
So earlier this year, you said you would step away from the IndyCar Series as a primary driver. I mean, first of all, tell me what that means.
Well, when I said it was my last season, it's my last full-time season, right? I've been racing for, like I said, 23 years in IndyCar, and I felt like it was time to dial back a little bit and just pick a couple races a year to do, obviously the Indy 500 being one of them. So I announced that was going to be my last lap this year as far as doing a full-time championship. So, and that still stands. And but now with, you know, all this pandemic, we're reconsidering to see what we're going to do next year.
I originally, had this been a normal year, Indy would have been the first race of the season with the way you wanted to do it anyway, mm-hmm. with the limited season. Has it been kind of nice getting a few races in before Indy this year?
Yeah, actually it was. I was out of the car for 8 months. So granted that it was nice to get a couple races there and then now get ready to go. Although the month of May, it's always pretty busy. We have a lot of testing, so I wasn't too concerned, but definitely it helped me a little bit to have a couple races under my belt for sure.
Tony Kanaan, finally, you live in Indy. Other than living within a short drive of the track, I don't know, what do you like about living here?
Man, my family's here. My wife is from here. Her entire family is here. When I moved to America, I moved to Miami because it was closer to Brazil because of the weather. I mean, I didn't do well with winters. I don't think I still do, but what I keep hearing, nobody does, even the people that live here. But the city, the environment, a place to grow your kids. I mean, this is such a nice community that once, we have four kids and the kids started to grow, we had to make a decision. And I just love this place. It's an awesome place to live. It's an awesome place to educate your kids. So there is nothing that I don't love about Indy. You know, actually, I would say the winters, there are days, if you call me, I'll probably hate my life, but that's just the way it is.
He won in 2013, and he'll race again this year, though he's ramping down his IndyCar schedule, but he'll race in Indy as long as he can. Tony Kanaan, thanks for your time and all the best.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
We'll now turn to Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton, who's covering this year's race. Sam, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
So you were there for pole day last weekend. What was that like?
Very different than the previous few years that I've been there for pole day. Obviously a big day usually that has fans in the stands watching some of, the fastest times that might be on the track with the drivers. And this year it was just empty. You know, there was some media there and then as well as the drivers and the pit crews. That was it. There were people and fans that were outside of IMS, like trying to get glimpses through the fence. People still feel tied to this race. So you had some people outside of IMS, but inside, very quiet. And so when Marco Andretti did win the pole position this year, it was a little weird because it was very quiet. You heard some of the teams clapping and cheering, but it was very... the stands would have been going crazy and you would have had a lot of noise. And so it was just this very quiet, like, yay, he did it. And it was exciting, but it was just, this little moment where you're like a little bit, oh man, this is something that usually would have a lot more reaction and just had a little bit more quiet appeal. And Doug Bowles, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway president, was outside of IMS with some of the fans. And so he had apparently recorded, from what he mentioned on a press call yesterday, some of the fans reacting to send it to Marco Andretti. So he knew that there were people, that were very excited to see him win and got a little bit of chance to experience some reaction that maybe was missed without having fans inside IMS this year.
So if the race is this Sunday and today is Friday, that makes it carb day, which is normally a big day at the track and the surrounding area. I mean, are we still even marking carb day with anything this year?
Yeah, Matt, that's a very good question. It's carb day is not going to be the same this year, that's for sure. Usually you have music, you have all these things that make carb day what carb day is, and it's going to be very different than previous years.
You're getting to do what not many people can this year. What's it like to just simply walk into the track right now?
Yeah, it's a lot of protocols are in place, obviously. So it's been a different year when it comes to being media inside the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. I mean, you're getting health screened going in, filling out forms, about to help them understand what contact tracing. A lot of precautions in place. And when you're inside, after getting through all the clearance areas, you're pretty much then, you're wearing a mask, there's hand sanitizer everywhere, it's social distancing. I mean, they've spread media out into different locations. There's two different locations for media this year. And so it's very different. It's something that typically we would be able to go back to the garages where they're working on the cars and talk to the teams there. That's not happening this year. We have like a little special designated area if we're going to do media interviews with the drivers or teams. We're not able to go down the pit lane this year, really. I believe some photographers might be able to. There might be some limited access, but for most of us, that's not something we're able to do. That other years, we'd be able to go out there up until like a little bit before the race, and that's just not happening this year.
You mentioned some of the fans congregating outside of the track. I mean, it's hard to stop some of those fans. Are there any problems with that? Any risk for liability or anything?
Yeah, and this has been brought up a couple of times to the IMS president, Doug Bowles, and people have asked him a little about the concerns with that. And continuing himself, Mark Miles with Penske Entertainment Corp., several of, you know, the head Indy 500 officials, so to speak, have really encouraged fans to stay home and watch the race from their televisions, explaining that's, you're going to have a better view. You're going to see a lot more than what you might see from a fence at IMS there. And really, you'll get a better enjoyment maybe of seeing it on TV to be able to see the full picture of what's happening and everything else. And right now, though, they still expect some people will come, though, and stand outside just due to the emotional attachment to the Indy 500. And they know those people are out there. And their biggest thing that they've emphasized, Doug Bowles and several others, has just really been make sure you're following the state and local guidelines when it comes to health precautions in light of COVID-19. That's really the response we've had.
This is going to be a very different race without fans. But, I mean, if we cancel it all together, that'll be significant, too. I mean, the fans want it. They'll watch it on TV. Well, I guess what good is it to keep the race on?
Yeah, so the best analogy I could think of right at the moment is the Indy 500 is, in a way, for IndyCar racing, the Super Bowl of their season. So it's a big deal. A lot of sponsorships are on the line, and that's, you know, revenue for the teams. So, I mean, the fans are a huge part of it, and that is a big portion of what makes the Indy 500 the Indy 500. But, I mean, for teams, sponsorship deals have to be fulfilled for them to continue to, you know, have the financials to keep running. So there's a lot more on the line than necessarily just having the fans there, and it's a big disappointment. But this race needs to happen from what I've talked to, when I've talked to some of the teams and the drivers, just for the sustainability, so to speak, in the auto sport racing.
We just heard from Tony Kanaan, which was awesome. I can't believe I got to talk to him. He's a fan favorite. He's a winner. But he races for one of the bigger teams, AJ Foyt. What does the race mean, this particular race mean, for some of the smaller teams?
Yeah, Matt, that's a good question. And I've got a chance to talk to Ed Carpenter from Ed Carpenter Racing. He's an owner and a driver, so a very unique perspective there, as well as some of the other drivers for Dreyer and Reinbold this year, J.R. Hildebrand and Sage Karam. And a big thing that they've mentioned talking with some of them is for the smaller teams, when we talk about the sponsorships, this even becomes even more critical. Some teams even out there, just they don't necessarily race in all the races, but the Indy 500 is one they choose to race in. And when I remember talking with J.R. Hildebrand, he mentioned a lot about this race helps keep people employed with the teams, and that's through the sponsorship deals and everything else. So for the smaller teams, this maybe has a bigger emphasis even for them when you're looking at the logistics of how do they financially operate the next year and continuing to be able to be a team in IndyCar series.
Tony also talked about some of the technical differences running the race this time of year versus late May. What are you hearing from the race teams about that?
The biggest thing, Matt, that I'm hearing is really in regards to the heat on the track. Some drivers have described it almost as feeling like a little bit of a slipping feeling with the tires. But I know that when we looked at time trials, you could easily see a pretty strong correlation between those who drew earlier spots had faster times than those who were in later in the day. So, like, for example, Marco Andretti's time trial spot that before the Fast 9 shootout, he was averaging a speed over 230 miles per hour, versus further down the line, you have the drivers towards the end of it were averaging maybe 227 miles per hour. So substantial difference.
Now, normally the race, of course, is a big boom for business in the area. Do we know anything about the economic impact this very strange year is going to have on the town of Speedway?
So, yeah, I've talked to the town manager, Carlos May, about just maybe an idea of what this might look like. And really, he's not fully sure. When I asked him exactly, like, what are you looking at for budget? Some of that's still up in the air, I believe, when I talked to him. Obviously, they expect some sort of financial hit because, you don't have necessarily all the revenue that would come in through taxes and other things during the month of May, because Indy 500 isn't just a one-day event. It's a whole month almost leading up to race day, and that's just not a thing this year. And so, and then without even having fans coming through this year, it does make a big difference. And I mean, I talked to one business owner, Dawson's on Main, about, you know, how it's impacting their business, and COVID-19 has impacted business because of closures. And one thing that has been done in the town of Speedway is they started looking at how this impacts nonprofits in that area. There's an estimated more than $250,000 that's going to be lost for nonprofits due to the Indy 500 not having fans there. That's usually revenue that's generated through fundraising or through events. So that's another major loss for that area, is going to be just not having the nonprofits able to maybe do all the services and operations they're typically able to do due to not having fans at the Indy 500 this year.
Samantha Horton is our business reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and she's one of the few people who will be at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway for this year's Indy 500. Sam, have fun, and thanks for your reporting.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
And we'll look for you on TV. Up next, an update on what's going on now that most schools are back in session. Jeannie Lindsay reports on what's going on in Logan Sport in just 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. When the pandemic started, one of the largest outbreaks in Indiana was in a seemingly unlikely place, mostly rural Cass County. Numbers there remain much higher than the surrounding counties. Here to talk with us about how it's affecting education there is Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay. Hi, Jeannie.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not too bad. But what do we know about the reason for the high numbers in Cass County?
Right. So there is a meatpacking plant in Logansport, and a lot of cases came through that plant early on back in the spring. So if you're looking at the data, there's a huge spike there, and a lot of people were pointing to this meatpacking plant. I'm not a health reporter by any means. I didn't get too into the details there, but that was a significant, I guess, focus point of the outbreak there early on.
Have they been able to get a handle on positive cases? I mean, are things looking any better there?
Yeah, so definitely the spike was kind of a one-time thing back in the spring. So looking at the data now, you know, I've got the graph in front of me, it flattens out a lot over the summer. You know, we've seen some upticks as things have reopened and, you know, people have started getting out and about more, but definitely not anything near the number of daily reported cases that they were seeing. At one point, they had, I think, 700 new cases. The spike that I'm looking at on this graph right now is just above 400. So, that 700 number didn't happen all on the same day, but it was in a few days. So it happened very rapidly. But now things have definitely calmed down quite a bit. A very, very different situation.
So then how did Logansport Community Schools handle e-learning in the spring, as almost every other school district had to?
So the date that keeps coming up was that March 13th. I think it was a Friday, actually, which is kind of ominous in itself. But people weren't really expecting that change. They weren't expecting, you know, to stop school and then to not go back for the rest of the spring. So Logansport ended up sending their younger grades home with their laptops, their devices. They're a district that already kind of pairs students with technology in their grades, in most of their grades, if not all of them. And so, you know, they sent kids home. I talked to some folks there. They said it was exciting for their little learners, you know, elementary school kids. It was like Christmas, you know, taking home their laptops. But for everyone else, it was kind of scary. They weren't really expecting it. But they did take some of the waiver days that were offered on the back of their spring break or around their spring break to take some time to plan, to do some of the coordination with their teachers, because because it was, you know, as every other school district will tell you, it was very abrupt. It was very sudden, unexpected. So they did a lot of meetings and a lot of coordination on the district level to push out videos and kind of centralize some of that information for instructors. But a lot of it was, as described to me, coordination, doing the work on the fly. So not a ton of time to prepare, but they worked with what they could.
So, I mean, then the school year ended, and then we had to think about reopening. How has reopening evolved over the summer for Logan Sports Schools?
Right. And so a lot of schools, I mean, they've had to navigate the constantly changing information, the guidance that came out from the state. They were waiting for that. And then once that came out, they had more pieces of the puzzle to work with. But, you know, even after the guidance documents have come out, the key word that everyone has been using is flexibility or subject to change. And so it has just been reacting to the new information that's provided by the CDC, by, you know, the Department of Education, you know, the governor. And so, and keep in mind, they have to push all of this information out to families too, as they're crafting their reopening plans and communicating how the district is going to operate. You know, they have to relay the information they're receiving and get people on board to kind of buy into, you know, the why, the reasoning behind all of this, because it is a novel coronavirus, and there's a lot we don't know about it still, and schools have felt that in their planning process. And so in Logan Sports specifically, I went to a couple of school board meetings back in July, and they were coming up with their plans. They had a lot of committee meetings, a lot of folks to give their input. The mask requirement that Governor Holcomb handed down, that changed their plans. Again, the requirements, the health recommendations, that changed their plans. And then, you know, at one point, they actually delayed the start of school, and that's something that I briefly mentioned in my story, but, you know, they pushed that back a little bit. In order to get a better grip on things. They didn't have any, you know, confirmed cases or anything like that that was making them, you know, push back in the school. And they weren't necessarily worried about an uptick in the outbreak because, as I just mentioned, you know, numbers have been pretty steady and low there since the spring outbreak. But it's been a lot of change in a very short amount of time.
So what learning options are they providing to students? Are they hybrid? Are they online only? Are they in person? What are they doing?
Yeah, so they are offering remote learning, and they are offering in-person learning. So the delay that I just mentioned, they initially only received word from about a dozen families who were interested in doing the online learning option, where they'd be full-time online. And then registration happened, and nearly 600 kids enrolled in online learning. So that was a big difference, especially Logan Sport is not a huge school corporation. You know, it's the biggest one in Cass County, but their enrollment is only about 4,300 kids. So, you know, taking that almost 600 of them online unexpectedly was a huge change. So, you know, they've had to do some adjustments there. But those are the two options that they're offering right now.
So when are they starting, or have they started?
Yeah, they started this week, actually. Tuesday was the first student day. They initially were going to start last Wednesday, but they really wanted, you know, after this wave of online enrollers, they really wanted to have more time to train teachers and to figure out, you know, who was going to be running the online stuff and who was going to be running the schools in person, because, you know, there's just so much that has changed, and the online component is more and more often than what they've done in the past.
So how are the teachers and the students, for that matter, getting used to the e-learning tools that they're using?
That training time that they had, you know, once they delayed the start of the school year was really critical. That's something that has come up in the interviews that I've talked to with folks up there. Curriculum director Lindsay Haggerty says that the training piece was very, very important because, you know, as I said, you know, teachers up there have not been used to using these online tools so often or as comprehensively as they, you know, normally would. So there was a lot to figure out, a lot of kinks to work out, you know, how to work their Google Classrooms and how to make sure that, you know, videos play at the right level or, you know, that students can access those and that also teachers are comfortable, you know, troubleshooting any problems that they come up with as well as doing instruction. And so one of the other things that they've done in the district is they've considered how to pair different teachers with different grades. And so here's Lindsay Haggerty, the curriculum director, talking a little bit about, you know, how they were thinking about the teachers pairing in the grades.
In the past, they were all classroom teachers at one point in their career. So that's not new to them. We also were really intentional about pairing them with a grade level they were comfortable with or that they previously taught.
And so right there, she's specifically talking about some of the support staff that they had to pull into remote learning. They don't have just their regular classroom teachers who have been teaching classes this whole time, you know, doing this remote instruction. They've pulled in specialists and English language specialists. And so they've had to, you know, adjust a lot of the roles there.
We're talking with Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter Jeannie Lindsay about reopening, and we're talking about one specific district, Logansport Community School. So is there anything particularly challenging about e-learning there in Logansport?
Yeah, and the one of the unique pieces of the Logansport school district identity is how many English language learners they have there. That was one of the reasons why I was actually pretty interested in going to Logansport and talking with the folks there is because, you know, according to state data, nearly a third of their students are English language learners. And then when they moved to this remote learning option, the curriculum director, Lindsay, she was telling me that about a quarter of their students who are learning online are English learning students. So these are kids who don't speak English as their first language. You know, and the other thing about that term, English language learner, they don't all speak the same language, like Spanish. They come from all over and they speak, you know, different languages. And so that has been something that they've had to get more of their educators on board with, especially with the support staff who normally would be pulling those kids out and doing that some of that English language instruction. Those teachers are teaching classes of their own now remotely. So that has been a very important piece to make sure that everyone has enough training to do that work.
Well, what does staffing look like? Do they have enough people?
Some of the things that we've been hearing about on kind of a wider scale, you know, people have been concerned about retirements or people leaving the profession of teaching. That's not something that I heard in Logansport. You know, I heard word of, you know, a couple people who had retired out of concerns, but maybe also they were going to retire anyway. So that wasn't a huge thing in Logansport by any means. But I think it's fair to say that folks are feeling tight on resources. They're feeling a little spread thin. And, you know, again, it goes back to that training piece and the delay that they had, you know, that was really critical so that they could have everyone take on more of a role or change their role a little bit with a limited supply of, you know, people to teach these classes. So definitely tough, but I don't know if it's necessarily dire as, you know, some other places might be.
What kinds of challenges does social distancing pose for learning?
So learning is a very multifaceted thing, especially when it comes to younger grades. I focused a lot on the elementary school. And so there's a lot of the social emotional pieces, you know, social distancing and, you know, keeping kids away from each other is really hard because, you know, when I was at the elementary school this week, kids want to wave to their friends and hug their buddy, you know, and hang out with their pals that they normally would get to play with on the playground. And so that's really hard to adjust, I think, and kind of just reorient, you know, kids who are coming back to school and might, you know, want some of that normalcy and some of the ways that things were. But one of the other things that is challenging with the social distancing component in terms of academics, Lindsay, the curriculum director, she was telling me that assessment is going to be really tough. Use of space is definitely huge. You know, people have limited square footage in their schools, but it's it's also, again, use of staff. So here's what she had to say about, you know, past tests versus testing this year.
We kind of had a method to our madness on getting through testing before, but many of those staff members who would help with that assessing have now been distributed to remote learning.
So that's a big question for her. You know, it's one thing to do school tests, you know, in classrooms, but it's a whole nother thing to do state standardized testing. You know, there are a lot of requirements about security there and proctoring. So that's going to be a pretty big question mark for now.
You talked to a counselor who was once an English learner herself. What did she have to say about the situation there?
Yeah, so she said her experience in the school corporation, you know, she used to work at the elementary school. She used to go to the schools herself, and now she's a junior high counselor. And she said, you know, the social piece of it is really critical. Kind of going back to having kids in school, everyone that I talked to really agreed that their preferred thing would be to have kids come back. But she also said she's really grateful that there is this option for families who need it. Especially someone was telling me a story about, you know, a student who did remote learning because this kid's mom just had a baby. And, you know, the pandemic going on, you know, being able to provide this option has been really critical for families who feel that they need that and prefer that option right now. But, you know, this counselor I was speaking with was saying that especially for English learner kids, that social piece is really critical, especially as they're learning a language. You know, having that in-person instruction and that sort of immediate feedback of, you know, pronunciation or, you know, having just the cues that are not, you know, verbal language, you know, acting out or, you know, giving some of those visual prompts to help kids learn this language. You know, English is hard. So she was saying that that's really critical. And so she's glad that there are students who, you know, are able to come back and who are able to get that sort of instruction. But there are definitely still concerns about kids who are learning remotely, even if they're not just English learners, because, you know, there's a lot of questions, you know, if they don't show up to their virtual classes, it's hard to get in contact with them.
Reopening is also taking a big toll on superintendents. What did this one have to say?
Yeah, so I talked to Superintendent Michelle Starkey up in Logansport, and she said she's glad it's not her first year on the job. So, you know, that was something that she was really grateful for. She's been superintendent up there for 9 years, and she that's her community. So she was really grateful that she has that experience under her belt. But, you know, she also talked about, you know, being a superintendent, it's kind of like spinning plates a lot. And this year she was saying it feels like some of those plates are cracked, but, you know, she's also the leader of her district. And so there are expectations for her to guide the ship, so to speak. And here's what she said when I was asking her about just how she's been feeling about all of this.
But you have to remain that cheerleader for your district. You have to be the strong one so that they know, look, she's not going to crack. She's here to support us. And I am, but it's difficult. I'm not going to lie. It's the hardest thing that I've ever done.
So, yeah, just the planning and the weight of all of that, you know, and the responsibility for her students and her staff and her community, there's definitely a lot of pressure.
How does she feel about the guidance she's getting from the state level?
Yeah, so she says that she's appreciated what they've tried to do. One of the things that she said she's tried to keep in mind is that, you know, this is something that people have never done before. It's brand new. So, you know, she's appreciated some of that. She says on the one hand, it'd be great if someone could just come down and say, this is how we're going to reopen schools. But she also said on the other hand, she gets that, you know, it's not the same in Logansport as it is for Indianapolis or Evansville or, you know, or East Chicago. So it's very different, you know, depending on where you are. And so it's kind of a mix of both. You know, she would love more, but at the same time, she's grateful that there isn't. So it's kind of a hard middle ground to walk on.
Jeannie Lindsay covers education for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Jeannie, thanks for your reporting.
Yeah, Matt, thanks for having me.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Monday, we'll continue our series on the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards. We'll hear from all four authors in the genre category. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. In the meantime, I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is All In.